to the king.
Unto the king.
O Padisha.
Padisha.
Having advice. Vipraha. Persons well versed in the Vedas.
Persons well versed in the Vedas.
Jataka-kovidaha.
Jataka-kovidaha.
Persons expert in astrology and. Go ahead. Persons expert in astrology.
Persons expert in astrology.
And in the performance of birth ceremonies.
And in the performance of birth ceremonies.
Labdha apachitayaha.
Labdha apachitayaha.
Those who had received.
Those who had received.
Sumptuously as remuneration.
Sumptuously as remuneration.
Sarve.
Sarve.
All of them.
All of them.
Pratijagmuhu.
Pratijagmuhu.
Svakan.
Svakan.
Their own.
Grihan.
Houses. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Thus, those who are expert in astrological knowledge and in performance of the birth ceremony instructed King Yudhisthira about the future history of his child. Then, being sumptuously remunerated, they all returned to their respective homes. Responsibly. Thus, those who were expert in astrological knowledge and in the performance of the birth ceremony instructed King Yudhisthira about the future history of his child. Then, being sumptuously remunerated, they all returned to their respective homes. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Vedas are the storehouse of knowledge, both material and spiritual. But such knowledge aims at perfection of self-realization. In other words, the Vedas are the guides for the civilized man in every respect. Since human life is the opportunity to get free from all material miseries, it is properly guided by the knowledge of the Vedas in the matters of both material needs and spiritual salvation. The specific intelligent class of men who were devoted particularly to the knowledge of the Vedas were called the Vipras, or the graduates of the Vedic knowledge. There are different branches of knowledge in the Vedas, of which astrology and pathology are two important branches necessary for the common man. So the intelligent men, generally known as the Brahmins, took up all the different branches of Vedic knowledge to guide society. Even the Department of Military Education, Dhanur Veda, was also taken up by such intelligent men. And the Vipras were also teachers of this section of knowledge, as were Dronacharya, Kripacharya, etc. The word Vipra mentioned herein is significant. There is a little difference between the Vipras and the Brahmins. The Vipras are those who are expert in karma kanda, or fruitive activities, guiding the society towards fulfilling the material necessities of life, whereas the Brahmins are expert in spiritual knowledge of transcendence. The department of knowledge, this department of knowledge is called Jnana Kanda. And above this, there is the Upasana Kanda. The culmination of Upasana Kanda is the devotional service of Lord Vishnu. And when the Brahmins achieve perfection, they are called Vaishnavas. Vishnu worship is the highest of the modes of worship. Elevated Brahmins are Vaishnavas engaged in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. And thus, Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the science of devotional service, is very dear to the Vaishnavas. And as explained in the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is the mature fruit of Vedic knowledge and is superior subject matter above the three khandhas, namely karma, jnana, and upasana. Amongst the karma khanda experts, the Jataka expert, Vipras, were good astrologers who could tell all the future history of a born child simply by the astral calculations of the time, Lagya, Lagna. Such expert Jataka Vipras were present during the birth of Maharaj Parikit, and his grandfather, Maharaj Yudhisthira, awarded the Vipras sufficiently with gold, land, villages, grains, and other valuable necessities of life, which also include cows. There is a need of such vipras in social structure, and it is the duty of the state to maintain them comfortably, as designed in the Vedic procedure. Such expert vipras, being sufficiently paid by the state, could give free service to the people in general, and thus this department of Vedic knowledge could be available for all. Translation again, text 29 of Srila Prabhupada. Thus, those who are expert in astrological knowledge and in performance of the birth ceremony instructed King Yudhisthira about the future history of his child. Then, being sumptuously remunerated, they returned to their respective homes. In this purport, Prabhupada gives a hint of his declaration that he couldn't think small. In the last 3 years of his sojourn on earth, he was emphasizing the need for varnashram, or dividing of society into the four varnas and the four ashrams. He didn't talk about this much in the earlier part of his career or on this earth. He said that in those earlier years, he was very fond of saying that if we asked everyone to be brahminical in the beginning, they just wouldn't agree to do the things that they have to do, like work under cars, get their hands dirty in the soil, and all that sort of thing. But later on, he emphasized the importance of varnashram. He said only half of his work was done. His thinking big was to want all of society, not just ISKCON, but all of society, to divide itself properly in the Vaishyas, in the Varnas, and the Ashrams. Of course, this didn't happen, but it's part of Prabhupada's overall plan. One thing that this brings to mind is that Prabhupada didn't bring just a philosophy, but he brought with him a culture. And that part of that culture was the varnashram side, was to divide society into the different varnas and the different ashrams. Of course, nowadays we have a sort of a, you might call it a perverted version of the varnas and the ashrams. You have the Brahmins, which are the intellectuals. Of course, everyone in one sense is like a Vaishya. They're all trying to make as much money as possible. But they are Vaishyas of a sort. And Kshatriyas, we could say that they're the military people, or the generals, or the whatever they are, and soldiers. And then you have the Shudras, which are the workers. And in Varnashram society, as far as I know, they constituted approximately 80% of the population. So a majority, many of the people today are in the Shudra category. Although there's another injunction that says in the age of Kali, everyone is born a Shudra. Everyone is interested in wine, and interested in women and money, and sleep. Everyone likes to sleep in the Shudra category. So in a sense, everyone is a Shudra. But there's a kind of a Suri Varnashram society that exists. It's a kind of perverted version of proper Varnashram dharma. So Varnashram doesn't exist exactly. When there was an open day coupled with the Rath Yatra festival here, it was excellent preaching because it kind of indicated that devotees could be other than just happy people chanting on the streets in pink bed sheets and having good food and having, you know, a very happy sort of lifestyle. But that people thought was weird. But when a number of the neighbors and some of the council people came here, and they were all nearby people, some of them were from somewhat farther away, they realized that there's an element to the Krishna conscious people that was sort of sophisticated, educated, intelligent, aware of what's going on, or au courant is the French word for current, and cultured. Part of it was the fact that there was a big stage and everyone had chairs to sit in. And there was a big video screen. It was huge. It was like 3 or 4 meters one way and about 3 meters the other way, or 4 meters the other. Was that the size of it? It was quite a big thing. And there was some video of the event so that people could see everything that was going on the screen that they couldn't see otherwise. So it was a way to it kind of showed that devotees can be expert in a lot of things. One of the qualifications of a devotee is daksha, or expert. And Prabhupada calls it daka, because I think it's part of the Bengali accent that when you have a K and an S, it's pronounced like K, like Kshatriyas and daka instead of Kshatriya, and daksha, like we say. But anyway, it is one of the qualities of a devotee. And Prabhupada gives an indication of this when he says that the Brahmins had to. Even the expert in everything, including military stuff, being good archers. Arjuna was considered the best student of Dronacharya because he was an expert at bowmen. One of the ways that he was considered expert was that whenever he was asked to hit a target, he couldn't see anything but the target, whereas other students were very easily distracted. Therefore, Arjuna won the hand of Draupadi because he fired an arrow through a spinning spoked wheel to a very small 1 or 2 centimeter target. And he couldn't look at the target directly. He had to see it through a reflection in the water. So that was expert bowmanship. One of the elements of Bhagavad Gita that's really important is that Arjuna was not a learned scholarly type. He was basically a soldier, a very expert soldier. Of course, he was in a royal family, so he wasn't an ordinary person. But he was very expert at this fighting. And one of the things that this indicates is that you can, in bhakti yoga, that you can do anything that you're good at and do it and learn how to do it for Krishna. And if you do what Krishna says, and it's even opposed to standard things that you've learned are good and correct, that's the most important thing. Of course, we have the corporate word of clergy abuse, that sometimes people abuse the word clergy, so that or they think, and sometimes this is prevalent in all faiths, not just in ISKCON, but everywhere. Not just everywhere, but also in ISKCON, I guess is probably a better way to say it. People in the name of doing it for God can do anything, including murder. It's interesting that I think Martin Luther King gave me this book about it. It was called The Plot to Kill Gandhi. And according to this book, and I read the whole thing, it was a very interesting book, and it was printed very poorly, printed in that part of the world where they couldn't find probably a good printer to do it. But it's interesting that when the person who pulled the trigger, of course he was a criminal, he was a big assassin, went to court, and it took almost a year before this thing was adjudicated properly and he was ultimately executed. In his confession, he wrote that there were two wars in the history of the Vedas. One was the war of Battle of Kurukshetra, and one was the war between Ravana and Rama. So he was indirectly indicating that that Vaishnavas, they weren't just passive resistors. A lot of people have this kind of false impression that we always turn the other cheek in every instance. But there are instances when we can become angry. In fact, you could say that the whole of the Bhagavad Gita was Krishna trying to make Arjuna angry enough to fight. And he didn't really want to do it, but that's what was transpiring in the Bhagavad Gita. He was becoming angry. And anger is actually one of the rasas. It's not one of the primary rasas, but it is a rasa. It's one of the secondary rasas. And I think it was Kamsa who was always meditating on Krishna. He was thinking, I'm going to kill him somehow or other. So he got salvation because he was actually meditating in his own perverted way on Krishna. So he was absorbed in this kind of rasa, very, very perverted, but it exists. So the point is that whatever Krishna does, whether he kills or whether he blesses, gives great wealth or high position, it's all being done, it's all for the good of the person who's doing it. I know it's a little hard to understand how Krishna killing somebody could be a good thing, but it actually is a form of salvation according to the principles of reincarnation, of transmigration of the soul. And then in 1972, when Prabhupada was lecturing in, probably in Vrindavan, but he was talking about, he had this book, Nectar of Devotion, and he was lecturing from that book to various people. And he kind of asked the devotees, he insisted that they should ask him challenging questions about what he was saying. They shouldn't just blindly accept everything he said is true, but he was kind of indirectly teaching people how to think on their feet. So one of the devotees reluctantly put forward the idea that, well, what if everyone becomes Krishna conscious? How is the world going to go on? I mean, we need people, technology people, we need airplane pilots, we need technicians in various things. How is, if everyone becomes Krishna conscious and they just chant all day, how is the world going to go on? And Prabhupada's response to that challenge was that, do you want this world to go on, this world full of criminals, this world full of materialists, this world full of corruption? Do you want it to go on, to continue? I mean, and then he went on to say that the government doesn't want to have jails or prisons, but it has to happen because people break the law. They do criminal things. They kill people. They steal. They do all sorts of immoral things. So it was kind of like a slam dunk defeat of this ersatz challenge that he insisted on. And he was kind of thinking to get people to think on their feet. He wasn't just getting people to think that what's ever written in Srimad Bhagavatam is the absolute and ultimate truth, because people tend to think that that's doctrinaire, or that's just, you know, it's not provable. One of the things that was good about this event, this Rath Yatra Open Day, was that it kind of demonstrated that we don't just depend on what's said in the books, or the books of truth, but we're able to utilize everything in Krishna's service, whether it's technology or dancing or whatever it is. It can be used for Krishna. So that's one of the things that made the Prabhupada was unique, and he demonstrated this. In fact, I think I read somewhere that one of the things that people stick to, I mean, it's kind of unfortunate, but it's an old tradition that they don't let people in Westerners go into Jagannath Puri. It's not the only temple, but that's a place where it's known that people of Western birth aren't allowed to go in. And it so happened, according to what I read somewhere, that Prabhupada wouldn't, even though he was invited several times, he wouldn't go into that particular temple because his students weren't allowed in. Although some got in by, you know, painting their bodies different colors, a few got in, but they were discovered. One of them was discovered, at least, and chased out. So it's difficult. To be a devotee. It's like we have to fight every inch of the way. I mean, the fight is not with the people, like some denominations think that everyone who's not a follower needs to be assassinated or killed. And that's just not Krishna conscious. The idea of Krishna consciousness is that we have to love everybody and everything and every even insects and plants. I mean, of course, there are a lot of people, a lot of advocacy groups now that are talking about nonviolence, and, you know, there are people, I think they're, I don't know, there are some sect that wears a surgical mask because they think that breathing microbes is not ahimsa, that it's very dangerous. But the hypocrisy of it is that the very same people who wear these surgical masks step on ants. So it's not just being an advocate or being a member of a particular religious body, but knowing the principle that Prabhupada gave us, or was Rupa Goswami actually gave us, and Prabhupada reiterated, was that of Yukta Vairagya. Yukta Vairagya Uchite is the last part of that verse that Rupa Goswami gave. And it means that everything, except for, of course, envy, just about everything could be used in Krishna's service. This is something that's unique. Anasa kasya visham yataram upayunjita nirbanda krishna sambandhe yukta vairagya uchite. That there's a philosophy as to how much technology we can use. Not just that if we're excessive, that's not a good thing. We depend on it. There are some people that would think that using a telephone is wrong use of technology. So, and I heard about this, that they don't They don't believe in it. And in their communities, they don't have telephones. They don't allow them. But people who want to use a telephone have to go out and use a phone booth. They would use it anyway, but they that's the hypocrisy of it. They don't agree to use it in the philosophy. They say telephones are bad, but they allow people, they know whether they allow it or not is another thing, but they know that people have to use them. And they need to check on their relatives and friends in other parts of the world. And they go to phone booths to do it. So this is one of the hypocrisies about doing something that's moral, and Krishna did a lot of things that were immoral from the point of view of morality. Like he consorted with other people's wives, and one of his devotees, Prahlad, stood by and garlanded the killer of his own father. And Sanatana Goswami bribed some people and told things that weren't fictional kind of incidents to get out of prison. And he did a lot of things. So in a way, these things are, because Krishna does them, these immoral things, they become moral. And so this is the place where people go wrong, because they think they can do anything. And they say that, well, God proved it. The devil made me do it. I didn't want to. But it's okay to do anything. Ultimately, it's because God is all good and God sanctions it. If it's being done for God, I was just like Arjuna. I was killing for God, so I'm all right. So in Vedic culture, it was very sophisticated, and as indicated here in the purport, in the verse in the purport, the horoscope was read out as soon as a person was born. His future was foretold by expert astrologers or vipras and pundits. They even had a class of people that were called panegyrists. They were people who all they did was to glorify somebody who was usually a king or somebody, very, very highly elevated from a spiritual point of view. They were called panegyrists or panegyrists, I think. Bandhu Swami called them. It's a kind of an unusual term, panegyric. It's a matter of praising, just like there's the word philippic, which is based on Philip of Macedon. It's just the opposite. It's when, condemnation. It's a phrase. But anyway, it was a custom that people, as soon as they gave birth, as soon as birth of a child was there, the horoscope was given. And as indicated, the vipras, there were vipras that were not only expert in astrology, but were expert in medicine. They would give people some cures, they would bless them, and they had knowledge of medicine. They knew what medicines to acquire. And instead of getting paid by the hour or by the visit, they got paid and they got remunerated with gold, with silks and jewels and things like that. So it was a very a society based on mutual agreement and barter rather than today's exchange of money. I think it's kind of hypocritical that in some countries, of course I come from America, I have a lot to answer for, but when I went to a doctor once, I had to pay even before the doctor would see me, because they're so mercenary. It's just unbelievable. And once when I was in that country, person was checking out of the hospital and he had this bill that was tens of thousands of dollars, and he was just completely flabbergasted by the high amount that was levied. And he just, it was a very simple thing. He was only in there for about maybe a week, but he had a huge bill, thousands of dollars. And this was like 40 years ago. This is now, it's even more. Anyway, I'll read the verse again, and if someone wants to say anything or has any questions, I'll try to shed some light on it. Just at this time, King Yudhisthira was considering performing. Oh, sorry. So, his son would become famous in the world as Pariket examiner because he would come to. No, that's not the right one either. Thus, those who were expert in astrological knowledge and in performance of birth ceremony instructed King Yudhisthira about the future history of his child. Then, being sumptuously remunerated, they all returned to their respective homes. So I think that's it. Any comments or questions or reflections? Yes.
Thank you. astrology in the birth chart, it mentions the gunner of the child, or Vaishyashudra, Kshatriya, or Brahmana, and you're mentioning our problem with the divine society and divine ashram and dharma. So do we look at the astrology chart of a person to define their vana, or are we appointing someone to say, you are this, you are that?
Well, first of all, there's astrology, 90% of it is just plain hucksterism, or you know, it's just false astrology. Like, you can read a newspaper, and if you're an Aries or a Pisces, you find out what to do that day. So that's a way of exploiting people in the name of astrology. Astrology is actually a science, and things are calculated carefully. And they're not just to determine whether someone is a Kshatriya or a Brahmin or something like that. But it's to determine what their future and their past births were. I mean, we're talking about going beyond the present body, or going into past lives and future lives. It's not just what I should do today or tomorrow. What's good for me? And as I said, it's hard to find anyone today who's a good astrologer. Most of it is just they're charlatans, to be quite blunt about the whole thing. There's a lot of innocent people who think that it's just really sophisticated, but there are a lot of the fakers around, unfortunately, in this age. That's the way it happens. And I think there was a learned astrologer in the time of Krishna, when he was present on earth, who was asked to say what he was in his past life, and he was not only an astrologer but a very elevated Vaishya. This is in Chaitanya Charitamrita. This is narrated there, and he realized that this person who was asking him what his past life was actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Krishna said, "Well, you must have made a mistake, because in my past life I was the son of a cowherdsman. I was just a cowherd's boy, and that's what I am now." It was kind of interesting, but he knew that he was dealing with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So a good astrologer knows everything intimately. And personally, I don't trust very many people who are supposedly astrologers. But it has its benefit, and it is a great science. And Prabhupada observed some astrological principles, but he didn't recommend that everyone do it, although some people are doing it today. Some people are doing it well. But as I said, 90% or more of people who are practicing so-called astrology are charlatans, in my opinion, anyway. I mean, I'm not saying that one shouldn't use astrology to find out things like compatibility for future spouses, but one has to be very careful, and that's my thought. Any other comments? None? Okay, then. Oh, yes.
Remember, it seems that Srila Prabhupada, from the very outset, established at least the ashram, sorry, the vanashram, because immediately there's grihasthas, sannyasis, brahmacharis, and then vanaprasthas to come. So it seems it's really the vanas that we're concerned with more than anything else. Just ashram wise, we're reasonably established, you could say.
Yeah, I suppose so. People are concerned about what their varna is. There was a time, this happened around about 1973, I don't know the exact year, but in a temple, an ISKCON temple, the temple president said, "Today everyone is going to have to decide what your varna is." And it didn't happen, because Prabhupada did say that the varnashram, or varnas, were important. But he didn't indicate that they had to be engaged upon right at this moment. They were important. But he did establish, as you rightly said, the ashrams. He told many times that I want to create rabbinical society. The first thing is planning and ascertaining things according to knowledge, not just ad hoc thinking what's right. So there's an element of that in there. But as far as the varnas are concerned, I mean, there was one devotee who said that Varnashram College would have to be established before Varnashram could be established. So what is a true Kshatriya? What is a true Vaishya? What is a true Sudra? I think Giriraj once told a story that a very wealthy man lost all his money. This is when there was still some semblance of Vaishyaism still in the world. It was in that part of the world, too. And he approached someone who was also a Brahmin, and he said, well, what should I do? I was a very wealthy man, I lost all my money. He said, you see that rat out in the street? This is when, at the time when there was a plague in India. If you take that and return it to the government will reimburse you, because they do that routinely for everyone who gives them a dead rat, because that was said to be a carrier of the plague. So he did that, and gradually he became a multimillionaire again, a korpati, as they call him in that part of the world. And so he was manifesting truly Vaishya qualities. A true Vaishya is one who can just start with almost nothing and turn it into millions and millions of rupees or dollars. That's a true Vaishya. So that requires education or karma or something, but we don't have such people. I mean, there are a few rich, well-known people nowadays, but they're in the minority. In a sense, everyone is a Vaishya. Everyone is trying to become rich and make a lot of money. But they're not true Vaishyas in the sense that Vaishyas as they existed in the past, and Brahmins and Shudras aren't true. I mean, at one point I saw some people that were designated Shudras building a temple. They were women that were carrying 5 or 6 bricks on their heads. That's just unheard of today. And their housing were little tents that were erected right on the premises of the building site. And that sort of thing is just completely unheard of. But that's what a true Shudra was like, I mean, in those days. So that kind of varna doesn't exist anymore, but maybe it will in the future. At least that's what Prabhupada predicted. You want to say something? You look like you did. Go ahead.
And another thing, Guru Maharaj, it seems at least within ISKCON, we've never had any communities, including ISKCON, where we've reached a critical mass. We have a population that can warrant all the lines be fulfilled. So it seems that very few of those in these communities have to do everything anyhow. Have to be sutras and...
Well, then I think in the beginning that everyone did a little bit of everything. And I still did. It still exists. You could be a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, and a Vaishya, and a Sutra all in one. So that just goes to show that society isn't really, even within ISKCON, it's not completely divided. I mean, it may be in the future, but as you say, it's not now. Now, like there's something like 8 billion people in the world, and maybe at the most there's a couple of million who are either sympathizers or initiated. And I think that you gave me this thing that said that Yadananda in Sannyasi in Spain did some research and he found that if every life member, say there's 1 million life members now, wanted to get initiated, that every initiating guru would have 100,000 disciples, 100,000 disciples, 1 lakh of disciples, which was an argument for making more people Diksha gurus. But I don't know. It's just it's possible to make more Diksha gurus, but very difficult. So there's a movement to make it easier. It's I don't know if it's reached to the GBC level, but there's some kind of a movement in there. People who believe that. Yes?
So just on the point of Vanashram and implementing it widespread throughout the society, my understanding of the conclusion of Vanashram is actually to bring people to the point of Krishna consciousness. And so then if people are actually actively engaged on the path of Krishna consciousness, how relevant is Vanashram?
Well, as I said, Prabhupada didn't emphasize it at all in the beginning. He emphasized it more in the last few years, two or three years or 1 year of his sojourn on earth. He said, the other half of my mission is to divide the world into Varnashram. But it may happen even if we don't have Varnashram College. It's possible. I mean, Krishna can do anything. Just like in Bengal, devotees were working for years to amalgamate all the individual titles of the land and to make the West Bengal government somewhat favorable instead of communistic, atheistic, and unfavorable. But in a very short time, Krishna arranged everything. So even though, and the same thing happened in England at Bhaktivedanta Manor. We lost all the cases to make Bhaktivedanta Manor a place of worship. We lost a local case. We lost, it went to the Supreme Court of England. It went to the Court of Human Rights in The Hague. And all those, in every court case, the devotees lost. They weren't, they upheld the dictum that they couldn't hold public worship except for 2 or 3 days a year. No Sundays, no, never. But then, miraculously, I mean, the material point of view is that the liberal government in the local council became the majority by one vote only. It only lasted for about 4 months. You could say it was all a political maneuvering, but it was actually Krishna that was doing it, because people have faith that if they stayed there at Bhaktivedanta Manor and worship their deities and somehow or other, that was the most important thing, and somehow Krishna arranged it. They were very dedicated to what they were doing and to Krishna consciousness, and it was all arranged miraculously. It happened, and now they have public worship is bona fide. And the thing that goes on that's strange in England, the law is that the local government, in this their local planning permission, which is part of the local government, has jurisdiction over the central government in cases like this, in planning. And so what happened is it was coming to, they were, it was going to be, it was on the agenda to be discussed when the swing vote favored the liberals. And the central government people who do those kind of things were kind of watching this closely, because they could get, they had sent an inspector into Bhaktivedanta Manor to see what was going on there. And everyone thought, oh, this is nice, they like us. But they were calculating. They weren't either liking us or not liking us. They were calculating. And what they did was they were watching the local government discussion very closely. And I know this because I knew the person who was engineering the entire campaign. They had a news release, a 7-page news release, in case the council would have voted to outlaw public worship. And they had another 7-page news release written, all prepared ahead of time, on what they would say officially if public worship were allowed. And in the long news release, this is a bit of history. I know it's mundane, but this actually happened. The favorable news release said that they're not creating any adverse environmental impact, and on for 7 pages it went on to say that it's perfectly legitimate for these people to worship. And in the negative news release, they said, oh, they're ruining the environment, they're changing the nature of the people of the land, etc., etc. And ultimately, though, the local council voted to approve of public worship, and there was a big victory there. It couldn't be reversed, apparently. But it looked like political manipulation, like one very vociferous liberal or labor as opposed to Tory was convinced. But it was really Krishna that did everything. So even though it seems that Varnashram society is impossible because everyone's very materialistic, everyone is born a sudra, everything seems to be going in the wrong direction, Krishna can do anything. Just as the person who's the prime minister of India is somewhat of a Vaishnava, and there's a Vaishnava that's trying to run for the presidency of the United States. And these are kind of miraculous things. They're unusual things. And this, the chief minister of Bengal has become favorable towards, this is a miraculous thing, towards the movement. These are miraculous. So my point I'm making is that from a material point of view, it seems that Varnashram, if it's going to happen, is hundreds of years off. But it could happen tomorrow if Krishna wants it to happen. Yes?
Well, on that point, there's just an interesting section from a Prabhupada, if I can read it, about training. Okay. Prabhupada explains, simply enforcing laws and ordinances cannot make the citizens obedient and lawful. That is impossible. Throughout the entire world, there are so many states, legislative assemblies, and parliaments, but still the citizens are rogues and thieves. Good citizenship, therefore, cannot be enforced. The citizens must be trained. As there are schools and colleges to train students become chemical engineers, lawyers, or specialists in many other departments of knowledge. There must be schools and colleges that train students to become Brahmas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, Brahmacharis, Grihasthas, Vanaprasthas, and Sannyasis. This will provide the preliminary condition for good citizenship.
So this is, thank you very much for that. This is an indication that Prabhupada was thinking big. He wasn't just satisfied, he was satisfied to see many devotees from something going from zero to after 50 years into thousands of people and temples like this existing. But on the other hand, he knew that it was very small in relation to the entire world, which is going in the other direction. So sometimes he's recommending things like this. And there's another purport in the first canto where Prabhupada is saying that governments should support the movement, that type of thing. And he was saying that if everyone in the world observed the Ekadasi, they would save millions of dollars in grain raising grains, stuff like that. So he was actually thinking about these things early on, but he wasn't preaching it so actively until later. And this is kind of an esoteric thing that he was saying, only half of my work is done. It's not widely preached or told, but he did say it. And again, you have to sort of, weigh everything he said about Varnashram, not just take one thing and think that that's always true in all times and places. But nevertheless, it's there. So anything else?
Just one more. Yes. Following on what you were saying about what happened in England, which you went to after San Francisco, right?
Pardon?
You went to England after San Francisco?
Yeah.
You opened up 118 Frederick Street?
I didn't open it, but it opened.
Yeah, I went to a three Grihastha couple. I was just there. It's now turned into a laundromat, that whole corner. And when Prabhupada was there, he was washing people's brains. Do you see any prospect of, have you ever thought about, I guess, about visioning a big temple there on Golden Gate Park?
Big temple on Golden Gate Park?
Yeah, well, the park is right there. And it's on the corner, 580 Frederick Street.
Could happen.
Yeah, I think so.
Like 26 Second Avenue was reconverted into a modern day sort of temple.
It's still there, going.
Yeah.
Mostly closed up, probably.
No, it's not closed. As far as I know, there's a temple there now.
It is. It's still there, but it was closed.
Yeah, it was closed before.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, the Bucky Center. Okay.
Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.